Dawson and Charlie Charters. Given the subject we're discussing, it might seem rather odd to have such a lineup on this panel because all of them have been very successfully published. But in the background of most writers, there are a few literary disasters, and maybe we'll be hearing about some of them in this session. Incidentally, we will be signing our oeuvre in Merchant 2 after this. So wonderful opportunity to get a book, well, wonderful from your point of view, to get a book signed, wonderful from our point of view, because once a book is signed, it is defaced and cannot be returned to the publisher. I am prepared to put my reputation, such as it is, on the line by admitting that I wrote 4 very properly unpublished novels before I had one accepted. After the first rejection, I submitted the subsequent manuscripts under pseudonyms, thinking that perhaps it was my name rather than my writing that was at fault. the pseudonyms were all anagrams of Simon Brett, but I'm afraid publishers were no more welcoming to Tom St. Bryan, Osbert Mint, or even the sultry romantic novelist Britt Montez. After those 4 unpublished novels, I did, I'm glad to say, have a significant breakthrough. It suddenly occurred to me to write not something that I wanted to get off my eternally adolescent chest, but something that somebody else might want to read. Clever stuff. Things got rather better after that. Anyway, I'm going to start by asking each of our panellists for a piece of advice to a novice writer, possibly based on their own bitter experience, that would guarantee their book would never get published. And I'll begin with Tom Harper, a.k.a. Edwin Thomas. His most recent Tom Harper book is The Lazarus Vault. Tom, Edwin, what advice would you give to an aspiring writer to ensure that they never got published?
Well, it's hard to know where to begin. just to come clean, as Simon has on his own background, I've also had the only one, thankfully, novel that I wrote over a period of about 3 years.
Nobody likes the smart ass.
Well, but if you read this first novel, you wouldn't think I was a smart ass at all. I wrote it over 3 years with no real conception of what it might actually be about, or who the baddies were or what the plot was. And at the end of 3 years, I looked at it and I thought, this is just absolutely rubbish. And the one thing I did realise, to my credit, was that it was going to be a whole lot less work just to write a whole other book than to actually try and correct this. So there is one never, ever, ever to be seen manuscript lurking somewhere in the bottom of a box, a lead-lined box somewhere. I've got some sort of insight, I guess, into how not to get published or how to get published, because I used to organise the CWA debut dagger competition for unpublished authors, and as a result of that, I read through, in the course of 2 years, something like 800 opening chapters of potential crime novels. Some of them were very good, and some of them weren't very good. And just a couple of things, just actually to be practical for a moment, a couple of things that came out of that. One is that overloading your reader with characters on the very first page is particularly if you're the reader who's reading quite a lot of these, as indeed a publisher's reader will be, to say, gosh, Sarah thought about Ben and what he'd said to Kate the night before. She couldn't believe that Kate and Dean had managed to do that thing with, and you know, and there's like 17 names on a page, which is possibly the way people really think, but not helpful. So that would be one tip. I think it actually gets even more prosaic than that. The way you format a story, you know, there's a fairly well-established way in which books are written, where paragraphs are indented, sentences have full stops at the end. you have, a paragraph break indicates one thing, and then a line break indicates a greater break, and people just mysteriously don't format their writing that way. And it's actually, because our brains are trained to read it that way, incredibly hard to follow a story that's not laid out in the way that you expect a story to be laid out. And just my final piece of advice is to avoid intentionally hilarious malapropisms that makes the reader burst out laughing just when you're trying to build up attention. My favourite ever debut dagger entry, and I do apologise for the person who wrote it, is in the room. It was actually an entry coming along nicely, and there's some sort of chase, and the villain chases the hero, I guess, into the convenience store, and they're racing around the convenience store, And the hero ducks into the Isle of Crisps. Isle, I-S-L-E.
God. Thank you very much. It's very difficult, that Isle thing. I have a granddaughter called Isla, and she can't marry anyone called Dogs or anyway, let's move on to Belinda Bauer. Her career as a crime writer couldn't have got off to a better start because her first novel, Blacklands, won the CWA Golden Dagger. Her second, Dark Side, came out in January. Belinda, advice to someone which will ensure their non-publication?
Don't start your book. It's a surefire way, and although it sounds a ridiculous piece of advice, I think that anybody who has ever wanted to write and has imagined being a writer can almost get frozen in the headlights of fear of actually putting pen to paper. And you almost feel as though that it's almost enough just to talk about writing the book. People will see your talent, that'll be enough. You know? And so basically, I always remember seeing Frederick Forsyth before I started writing Blacklands, and I was toying with the idea of writing a book rather than screenplays, which is what I used to do. I saw Frederick Forsyth on a program about writing in the middle of the day, didn't even know what I was watching, and suddenly he popped up on the screen and somebody said to him, how do you write a book? And he said, you sit down and write 10 pages a day for 50 days and that's a book. And I thought, oh, I could do that. And I thought, well, that's kind of such a sort of a workmanlike approach. And that's basically what it is. Of course, you have to have a reasonable plot and some writing talent and all that sort of stuff. But you know, at the end of the day, you have to sit down, you have to start it, and then you have to finish it. And that's how you get the book, and that's what you need if you actually want to embark on the publication process.
That's very, very impressive.
Thank you. I just thought of it.
The one thing you didn't mention was quality control.
I have a lot of notes on quality control. I mean, don't believe anybody who loves you.
Okay. I'm going to move on now to Adrian Dawson. His first novel, Codex, had a rather interesting publishing history, and his second sequence is due to be published in September. Adrian, do you know the secret of not getting published, and would you be prepared to share it with us?
When I was asked this question, and I knew this question was coming up, I thought about it, and I thought, well, I'm kind of the luckiest unlucky author that I know, insofar as Codex was written in 1999. I did what I was supposed to do. I sat down, I wrote what I felt was the best book I could write, and I immediately sent it to an agent, and the first agent I sent it to snapped it up, started pitching it out at publishers, and tried to sell it. In Codex, there is a guy who has nigh on perfected artificial intelligence within computers. There is a guy whose computer systems think in a very grey way rather than just black and white. So all of 1999 and 2000, I got, you're just jumping on the Millennium bandwagon. And I thought, no, I'm not. These computers don't crash and the world doesn't end. It just so happens that the guy has computers. And this went on for me for about 2001, 2002. And then because there's code breaking and what have you in the book, I then got the next 6 years of people going, well, you're just jumping on the Dan Brown bandwagon. And what I became very aware of is that whilst I hadn't specifically tried to jump on anybody's bandwagon, had I done that, it would have been picked up on straight away. But had I sat down and thought, I am going to write the next Dan Brown, or I am going to write the next Michael Crichton, the publishers out there, certainly the quality publishers, they don't want to jump on bandwagons. What they want is something fresh and innovative, what have you. So finally, last year, Codex came out, and it raced to the top of the charts, and I felt vindicated, and I now really feel as though, you know, it was the book, the good book that I always felt it had been for 10 years. But what I've been very careful to do with Sequence, is which comes out in September, is just be careful that I'm not trying to do what I'm influenced by, because obviously I read as well. And whilst I'm influenced by prose, and I'm influenced by style, and I'm just... I've had 10 years of people accusing me of jumping on a bandwagon when I wrote the book 3 years before the bandwagon even set off from the station. So I really don't want to hear the words Dan Brown in any more of my reviews. So on the next one, I would just say, if you try and copy what you like, you will fall flat. If you go with what you want to do and it's innovative and it's coming from you, it will stand out in its own right. And that's the best advice I could give, I think.
OK, thank you very much, Edward. And we'll move on, finally, to tail end Charlie. Charlie Charters, whose first novel, a thriller called Bolt Action, has garnered some excellent reviews. As I asked the others, I'm going to ask you the perverse question, how not to get published?
The unhelpful piece of advice I would have is spend your time praying for random things. This is not the story of how Bolt Action was published, but the book that I wrote prior to that was almost picked up by a publishing company on the strength of the fact that the whole work was printed off and was put on one of these extraordinary stacks of paper, which you see in publishers' offices from the floor to the ceiling. The wife of the chief financial officer of this publishing company came in with her small yappy-type dog, which vomited on the carpet, and the publisher jumped up to mop it up and took three or four pages of my script and mopped up this vomit, which was perhaps what the book deserved. But he had this, and he'd sort of cracked the first two or three pages, and on the strength of that, he read that page, and he thought a page after, the page after. And from this slush pile, he eventually contacted the agent. And the agent contacted me, and he brought me down to London four times and was, on the editorial side, was tremendously excited, wanted the first 10,000 words for the next book. Book three, a sort of manifesto, synopsis over, you know, five books, how it was going to pan out. And that was all on the strength of this one extraordinary random incident. Now, as it turned out, the marketing department eventually shot the whole thing down. But it is a sad fact, or it's a true fact, that these tiny little microbursts of kind of random activity can unfortunately make the difference. You know, the talent is locked in, the script is there, you've ticked all of the boxes, and sometimes you just need something like that just to push you over the edge. So pray for little yappy dogs vomiting in publishers' offices.
Thank you very much, Charlie. You've given a whole new definition to the word slush pile. Or even slush puppy come to that. The other thing that always strikes me about sort of pre-published novelists, they have this section, they used to in the MWA in America, they had pre-published, which was a very good way of getting subscriptions from people who are never going to write anything. It's brilliant. And people are always very hot on the copyright lines of when they submit their manuscripts. And I remember I was judging a competition for plays, actually, and I read one play, which wasn't terrific. And at the end, the writer had put, none of the characters in this play bear any relation to any human beings, living or dead. And I thought, you are so right, lady. the history of publishing is littered with authors saying, oh, it's harder than ever to get a book accepted these days. If it had been as bad when I started out, I'd never have got published. Is that true, though? I mean, there are more books being published every year. Technological means of delivery of their contents are expanding exponentially. The self-publishing never been easier. So I'm going to ask the panel what they think of the current state of the publishing climate. Belinda, what do you
well,
think?
Well, I'm not terribly knowledgeable about this, I have to say. All I know is how I feel about the deals I've been getting and the money I'm giving in advances and stuff like that. But I think the recession has finally hit the book world, and it came a couple of years later than it did for the rest of the world, but it has hit hard, and it's hit home, and publishers are far more cautious about what they publish, they're far more cautious with their money. I think actually it's quite a truism at the moment to say that it's a pretty hard market to get into, and if you're in it, it's quite hard to stay in it in a sort of make a living kind of sense. So at the moment, I think we're going to go through tough years.
Yeah. So a lot more people will not be published, perhaps. Adrian, you know quite a lot about the technological developments and that kind of thing. Do you think it's a healthy climate in publishing?
I think the digital revolution that we're going through at the moment is it's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, it's made it very easy for anyone to write a book, turn it into an EPUB, throw it up online, mm-hmm. and there it is. Unfortunately, within that, there is the good and the bad.
Yeah.
It means that everybody who says, I can write a novel, is now doing it and throwing it up there. And it's increasing the bookstore through which you have to wade to find the good stuff.
Yeah.
But by the same token, what technology does allow you to do is download the first couple of chapters and make mm-hmm. that decision for mm-hmm. yourself.
Yeah.
And I've always, certainly with the sort of last history that I've had over the last sort of 6-7 years with the Dan Brown references, my book is in no way like Dan Brown's, but if you've to synopsize it into a little paragraph on the back of a novel, mm-hmm. you can see similarities. It's perhaps playing a different ball game, but on the same pitch.
Yeah.
And what I'm very pleased with, and it appears to have worked certainly on the digital side of things, is the fact that people can actually download a sample, read 2 or 3 chapters in, make a decision for themselves mm-hmm. whether it's worthy of buying mm-hmm. or whether it's derivative or non-derivative or whatever. And I feel while it opens the door to more people, what it does do is at least give them the opportunity to be read for a couple of chapters and set the stall out and see where it goes from there, really.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, what about you, Tom? Your view of state of publishing?
It's tough, I think. I signed up with my agent in 2001, and I went to see her and climbed 5 flights of stairs up to this tiny little office lined with books. And she sat me down, she told me a few home truths, and she said, stage publishing is absolutely dire. And I took this to heart. And that was in 2001, when advances were still pretty good, when we still had Borders on the high street. We still had lots of, I can't even remember all the chains. Otterkars was considered to be an exciting, up-and-coming kind of chain. And books were really booming in that sort of wave that happened after the abolition of the Netbook Agreement. As in, it was dire then, apparently. Some people know this, asked my agent quite recently, actually, I said, was it... She was complaining about the state of the publishing market. I said, well, was it not always dire? She said, oh, it's direr now.
Charlie, what's been your experience?
I think if you're... I mean, I wrote 3 books before the good people at Hodder were wise enough to see this rough diamond and pick it up and polish it so vigorously and publish it. I think it's hard to ask a debut author this, because when you get that publishing contract, you are so just beaming with delight that you are completely blind to any faults or challenges that the publishing industry may possess or may be going through. I think that to go to Adrian's point earlier, I mean, I think the technological opportunities that are there for, you know, in this new digital age are very exciting, but there always has to be a role for a publisher in being able to signpost the way to kind of quality works, rather than just have this kind of yellow pages phenomenon where you're going through page after page after page trying to find something that might be of interest. My background, before I started writing, I worked in sports marketing and I worked for FIFA. And FIFA is a rights holder, so they are the equivalent of the author. They create the live football, which the broadcasters fall over themselves to trying to buy. And to go from that business model, where the person who creates the content is so fabulously wealthy. I mean, when I worked for FIFA, genuinely, there were 2 occasions where we struck deals, and FIFA had so much money, they actually didn't know where to put these latest 2 deals. They had to create new separate bank accounts in order to be able to process the money. So to go from that model where the person who creates the content is just getting richer and richer through no kind of great skill or kind of work on their part to the author model is a very interesting inversion, as it were.
Yes, yes. And I think, I mean, what you describe, I think, I'm sure for all of us, you know, the first time someone expresses interest in publishing your book is a very magic moment. And I remember when that happened to me, I was working for the BBC and I immediately got out my calculator and said, you know, I've got to give up the day job and be a full-time writer. And I worked out that to match my then BBC salary, I could be a full-time writer so long as I produced a book a month. one thing I'd like to go on to, a necessary part of not being published is being rejected. We've heard a little about rejection. It's something that all of us experience, either in professional or personal lives, and in some cases both, sometimes continually. and incidentally, never believe that old mantra, the worst thing they can say is no. There are many worse things. Why have you sent me this pile of awful? I want to ask the panel about how you cope with rejection. May it happen to you very rarely, but I'm sure we've all had it at some point. Adrian, you've had this sort of long-delayed rejection, which was followed by the consummation of acceptance.
Yeah.
So that was rather good. But were something else rejected? How would you cope?
I've had rejection after rejection after rejection over the years. Yeah. You know, usually comparing me to other people in a way that they either felt detrimental to their business model or detrimental because they didn't like the author they were comparing me to. But I think, honestly, the most gut-wrenching rejection that I got was one where I sent it to a particular publisher. I felt that they were the publisher for me. I sent it to them and chased it up every so often. And just over 2 years later, a letter came back saying, I'm terribly sorry, we've not had time to read it, and returning it. And so it was 2 years of waiting just to be told that they didn't have the time to read it. And I think that to me was even more devastating than a quick answer of, no, not for us, off you go, find somebody else.
Yeah.
So
there was a famous case of a writer who sent a script to BBC Wales and got no response for a year, and then sent the script a birthday card. and it got a lot of coverage in the press. And then the manuscript was returned by the next post. So be a bit wary. Charlie, you've mentioned, the books that weren't published. Do you feel you're a stronger man from rejection?
Well, I do, because, certainly in my experience, and I don't know whether it's the experience of the other authors, the first book that I submitted, it was good enough to get an agent, but I look back at it now and it really was awful. And so I probably would have rejected it had I been on the other side of the table. There is something kind of quite unique about, and I've wondered whether or not publishers have a specific software that writes these incredibly enticing, we're just so excited by this, and da da, and it was just lovely, and the narrative arc is amazing, and the da da da, and then the final sentence is, but I'm afraid we've decided. I received a rejection letter which was 8 paragraphs of just undiluted praise. I mean, just so exciting. And then the final line pointed out that because I write in the present tense, this was not acceptable, and therefore we won't be making an offer. And I was like, I can just turn.
Have you written back and said, I'm happy to write it in the
Well, I don't. So I had this discussion with my agent. And he said, you just don't understand. That's code for no, thank you.
Yeah.
And I was like, my God. And just say no.
Was the rejection letter written in the present tense?
No, it was written in the future tense. We will not be making it.
Tom, what about you? Rejection, you said the first book. Did you ever offer the first book to anyone?
No, never.
You recognised its value yourself.
Self-awareness.
Yes,
yeah.
Good.
That's
admirable.
it saved me some time. I had sort of the opposite trajectory to Adrian, actually, or to Charlie, in that my first book was one of the rare good luck stories in publishing. I entered it for CWA Davy Dagger. I'm getting to this. Off the strength of that, I got an agent almost straight away and wrote the book and sold it almost straight away to a good publisher for a nice advance. And everything seemed fantastic. And they gave me a 3-book deal, and everything seemed really great. And after 3 books, I said, right, well, here's my proposal for the next 3 books. And they thought about it, and then you get this phone call saying, actually, we don't want to continue. And that was tough. In fact, you want to know how I cope with rejection?
Yes.
If you ever come around to my house and I'll cook you pancakes, and there'll be a dent in it because there's a dent in the pancake pan. made by a metal spatula.
Oh, really?
Wielded with great force the morning after.
I'm glad that you... Because I remember once trying to sell a car which had a sort of strange little indentation. And in fact, if you looked at it, it was knuckles. I'd actually punched it once when it wouldn't start. They didn't tell them. Of course, another way of not getting published, Belinda mentioned, is not writing anything. And most writers, at times, they say there are, you know, times when they can't write. This is sometimes dignified with the title of writer's block. Have you ever experienced, Charlie, have you hit writer's block?
I'm very reluctant to make eye contact with my publisher at the back, who knows that I suffer writer's block on a regular basis.
And is that when the World Cup's on?
It has a lot to do with the Cricket World Cup. It has a lot to do with England playing in Australia over the winter. It's a very kind of strange business, obviously, writing about make-believe people doing make-believe things. The slightest opportunity kind of not to do it, I will be the first one there. I'll beat anybody to be the head of that queue. I also have four children, and that produces its own kind of dynamic, which means it's very easy to allow yourself to say it's writer's block time. That's my explanation.
Okay. Belinda, have you...
Yes, I have had writer's block, and it is quite scary because, of course, there's nothing... You know, you can't really force something onto the page if it doesn't belong there. And if you do, you find you only have to rewrite it later. I find a couple of things have helped me get over this. One is I put on a CD very loudly and I dance, because I just sort of like, when I'm not thinking about things anymore, I get all kinds of ideas. Sometimes I get ideas for a completely different book, but it's still useful. When I wrote Blacklands, I also wrote another book at the same time, and I would get stuck on Blacklands and go over to the other book and vice versa. That was helpful. And, of course, talking about it with somebody whose opinion you trust and you know who's quite well read is probably the easiest way to get over a block. And then
talking about Work in Progress?
Yeah. Talking about, I know. I'm not talking about with everybody. I'm just a couple of select people, my boyfriend, my mother. I'll say to them, you know, this is the problem. I can't do so and so because of such and such. And this character won't do this thing, and he wouldn't have done such and such. And very often, the solution is very simple, but quite lateral. Mm-hmm. And somebody with a completely new set of eyes can look at your problem and see an easy solution to it. And so I wouldn't be talking about it much and very openly to a lot of people, because I do believe in this kind of synergy where you say something and either you lose interest in it yourself, or somebody else 1,000 miles away in China suddenly realises they're going to write that book and much faster than you. And all of a sudden you're sort of like behind the bandwagon, as Adrian would call it. But I think there's a few sort of techniques around writer's block. Doesn't mean they always work, but it's definitely worth trying them all.
Well, I'm very impressed that you talk about work in progress. It was Nabokov who said, showing people work in progress is like passing round samples of your sputum. Adrian, on the writer's block question.
I've always found that I can't actually sit behind a computer or a typewriter and actually write. What I do is... Currently, I have three chocolate Labradors, which get walked a good hour and a bit in the morning, a good hour and a bit in the evening. And I actually write in my head. There's a specific chapter that I need to work on, or it could be just some plotting or characterization or conversation between two people. And I play that out in my head, and I perfect it in my head. And I'm sure people see me wandering around the park having little conversations with myself, because I'm putting myself into both characters and trying to gauge how they would react. And I can sometimes not actually write for a day or two. It's just the process of walking the dogs, getting it absolutely fixed in my head. And then at the point I sit down, I'm really nothing more than a stenographer. I'm just... It just flows out the head onto the page, and then I go walk the dogs and attack chapter two. So, and as yet, I've not stumbled with that. So
good. Oh, well, this is... I mean, the one message that's coming very clearly is get a dog. Either it will work out your plots, or it will crap at a relevant moment. This is clearly going to be
perhaps
a help.
I should get mine to be thick on the manuscript before I send it.
But this thing of going for walks to, you know, I think a lot of writers do that, and I go for a walk around our little village every morning, and people at that time of day, they don't engage in conversation, it's just a quick nod. And I remember I met a woman who I'd seen on the walk, and I met her at lunchtime in the village pub, and she said, "Oh, I saw you having your walk this morning, Simon, but I didn't like to say anything because I thought you might be thinking." This carapace of thought. I think it's time that we opened this discussion up to our extremely distinguished audience to ask some questions. And I should remind you that there is a bag of books for what we deem, or what I deem, to be the most interesting or intelligent question. Lady at the back in blue.
I was wondering, in the interest of not getting published, if there's a way to start your first page, like perhaps with a dream sequence.
Well, did you all hear the question? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, certainly I would recommend a good way of ensuring that I didn't read the book would be to start in italics. Any bit in italics, I just don't read. But what about you, Belinda?
I don't particularly care for anything titled prologue.
No,
I always feel like I'm going to skip over a prologue anyway, so why is it there? I have actually written a prologue, but I kind of I fought against it. I think start with chapter one and go from there.
Yes. And of course, Wuthering Heights starts with 1805, which is possibly the most terrible beginning of almost any novel. Tom, what about?
Well, obviously, starting your novel with sort of 100 pages of really dense financial shenanigans in Sweden would be a sure way.
Don't do that.
That would never fly.
No, never catch on. Charlie?
I think, as a general rule, a very obvious way not to get published writing the opening chapter is if you are a man, you should not write lesbian sex scenes. I just think that's a. I tried that and it wasn't convincing.
Well, yeah. Sort of peeking too early.
Yes.
Adrian.
I'm at a bit of a loss actually after listening to Belinda, because in Codex I start with a quotation which I thought would look really good in italics. So I have one book which starts with italics and one book which starts with a prologue. So I would say categorically always write your book starting with either italics or a prologue.
Okay. Good. You heard it here first. Okay, lady in the front.
Yeah.
Yes, it's hiding under the table. It was released. The publisher that I'm signed to is an absolutely brand new publisher, and the way they decided to work it, for myself and future authors, is to release it digitally. If it does well, release it in print. But just kind of do that stepping stone, toe in the water kind of thing. Obviously now, based on the way Codex is going, I'm in a situation where everyone will subsequently come out digitally and in print at the same time. But they approached me with an offer which was basically, we will fund launching it digitally, we'll fund the promotion, we'll fund the tours. If it goes well, you know, we might see you in print. And it just went straight to the top of the digital chart. So it was me then knocking on the door going, print, please. And they were like, yeah, I think so. So, in December of last year, it came out in print. And as I say, Sequence will come out digitally and in print in September of this year.
Mm-hmm. Tom?
My books are also available electronically.
Oh, good. Yes. Shall we move? Lady, yes, there, in black.
Rejection letters that you've heard of, even from friends, because I'm sure you've heard of, you know, the myth rejection letters. What was the best rejection letter you've ever heard of?
I didn't ever get a rejection letter, but when I was a screenwriter, I did actually send Blacklands to 5 publishers, but none of them even bothered writing back to say no. So I never had a rejection letter, but I did once get fired from a job as a screenwriter. I was writing an adaptation of a book called Pope Joan, set in the Middle Ages, and worked with a very nice German producer who used to fly over and meet me in London. I live in Cardiff. And we worked on this book, this script, for about 7 or 8 months. And then, unbeknownst to me, he hadn't been showing this to the producers in Germany. And when he finally did, I went up for a meeting with him one day, and we were very close to the end of the script. And he just, they obviously hated it. And he fired me, pretty much on the spot. And one of the reasons he gave was because of my dreadful Dances with Wolves dialogue. And and I was so shocked and horrified. It was the only job I'd ever been fired from. And I just said, okay. And I went out, and it took me all the way to Bristol to remember that Dances with Wolves won 7 Oscars. And I was so annoyed with myself. That was painful.
Yes. Rejections, Tom? Nice ones, nasty ones?
I don't really read them. I mean, you get one, well, no, you get the sense. I mean, and then you don't care. I mean,
likewise. I mean, they're all sort of exquisitely drafted, the ones I seem to get, which just so tantalizingly kind of draw you in, and your heart beats faster, and then suddenly there's the kind of walk away scene.
Yes. I had an actor friend who used to write to various managements for jobs and constantly rejected. And he wallpapered his downstairs loo with rejection letters. And a friend of his was using the facility for quite a sustained period. And he came out and he said, "Hey, one of them is offering you a job." Sorry. Adrian, experience of rejection?
When I first pitched Sequence, that was completed a couple of years ago, and I first pitched it to a publisher, and it's kind of a time travel novel, and there are people out of sequence, and I wanted to build this very sort of out of sequence world with events happening in the wrong order and the way they converge to a point at the end. And I sent it to a publisher who sent it back and rejected it because it was anachronistic. And I kind of thought, well, that's kind of the point.
Yes. I remember, having a rejection. I wrote one of the unpublished novels, was called Cleopatra's Nose. And I had a rejection letter which said, "I'm afraid the current state of the publishing market is far too depressing for me to offer you any hope for Cleopatra's Nose," which I thought was rather elegant. And in fact, 30 years later, I did write it into a radio play, so nothing is wasted. Yes. Lady here in orange, would you call that orange?
I would call that orange.
Okay, yes.
I was wondering if a really good way not to get published would be, if you're rejected by an agent, to write back and tell them why they're wrong. Particularly if they give you any feedback. And if you're lucky enough to be accepted by somebody, you then ring them 5 or 6 times a day to check up that they're doing the work on your behalf.
Yes. No, that's a very good way. And I remember an editor friend of mine said, she said 3 things that will ensure that you will diminish your chance of getting published. One is regarding your editor's office as your office when you're in London, and using their phone all the time. And the other is having a friend in your village who could do the illustrations. She said, yours wasn't so much a question as a statement, but if anyone wants to pick up on it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the general rule is, the best way not to get published is probably give them hell. You know, I mean, if you don't make yourself thoroughly unlikable and roust about and get drunk and fall downstairs and make a fuss about things, how are they going to know you're the next Ernest Hemingway?
Right. Although the counter side of that is the sort of idea that the squeaky wheel gets the oil, and that you have to sort of balance it. You have to make a certain amount of fuss to make sure that they remember that you're there. But obviously not so much as to irritate them beyond tolerance.
Yes, a very fine judgment. Charlie, have you...
Well, I went on a writing course at one of the Arvon Foundations, which was transformative. I can't recommend it highly enough. And one of the things that they did say, and it's sort of inside knowledge, which is helpful, and this was not so much about getting published as getting the agent, because the agent is the first sort of circle that you have to break into, was do not submit your script immediately at the end of the school holidays, because the 300,000 teachers in the UK, or however many teachers there are, spend their school holidays writing their way out of being teachers, and literary agents are just, there's just a flood of scripts in that 2-week period.
Yes.
So send it in during the school holidays or before the school holidays, but it's death to send it in after the school holidays.
Very shrewd.
Yes.
What do you feel about dedications and how valuable are they? Or thank you to Jane Austen for inspiring you to write the books.
Dedications.
I like reading other people's dedications. Yeah. You know, even if I don't know the writer, I think some of them are, obviously they say things like thanks to John and Mary, and like, what was the point of that apart for them personally? But I think sometimes you read a dedication which really enriches your experience of the book. I think if a well thought out dedication is a really nice thing to read in a book.
And it's, I mean, people appreciate it. It's nice.
The people you've dedicated the book to, I think.
They really like it.
I mean, dedicating an entire book that you spent 2 years working on or something is no small thing. And so I think it's a really lovely way to say thank you to the people who've helped you get where you are.
Yeah, and even one that you spent 2 months on, you know, they appreciate that too.
to me as well. Adrian. When you see a movie and you always remember the director or the star, and obviously there's a huge supporting cast behind any movie. And I think it's the same with a book, that everybody remembers the name on the front of the book, but forgets that behind them, there are people who've done the washing up that night so that you can write, or, you know, various other things. And without that support, the book would not arrive. And I think some degree of acknowledgement within there, that it is a team effort. Yeah. It's almost, you know, as long as it's kept short, the dedication is really the cast list. It's the closing titles of everybody that helped make this book what it is.
And you'd put those at the beginning as a dedication,
yeah.
Right, at the end, right? Even down to the midwife who sucked the sputum out of your mouth. When
if I knew her name, yes. Yeah. If she wants to get in touch,
Charlie, dedications.
Yes, there's obviously a sort of political element in it, in that the two most significant women in my life are my mother and my wife. And trying to be able to organise the dedication so that one is not obviously placed ahead of the other is complicated.
You're going to write more than one book.
I am going to write, and the roles will be reversed. Famously, in The Persuaders, each episode had Tony Curtis first, then Roger Moore, and the next one was Roger Moore, Tony Curtis.
Yes.
So that's, I think, how I'm going to have to fashion it in order. For domestic harmony to reign in the household.
Yes, Tom.
I think it's nice to dedicate a book to someone, so that each book is associated perhaps with someone. You do have this issue of whether of sort of the hierarchy, and it really forces you to nail your colours to the mast and say you're more important than the person who gets book four. And the acknowledgements, I completely agree with Adrian. I think that writing, particularly if your book involves research or someone's got my book. Oh yes, my first book's dedicated to my wife at bedtime because she read each chapter at the end of the day as I'd written it. So that was that dedication.
Yeah, well, that's lovely. I dedicated my first one to my wife, I think, and then my 50th I also dedicated to my wife in case she felt neglected. But I have a friend, Peter Spence, who wrote To the Manor Born series, who, not so much dedication, when he's signing a book, he would always put to Deirdre, without whom this copy would not have been sold. Yes, a question at the back there.
Yes, I'm told that there are certain people in America that believe the world is going to end today.
Yep.
Do you know what time?
Well, I mean, clearly, don't read a book that hasn't been published. That is one thing. Yes,
skip to the end of the book you're reading now so you know how it finishes.
Yep.
I would say don't spend the rest of the day trying to get published because it'll be the most depressing day you'll have.
Tom?
I would suggest maybe inventing a time machine, and that way you could nip back and get some more time.
Very good. Yes, Charlie?
I have a 6-hour train journey back to York. And if you've ever gone cross-country in the trail, but you know it's very similar to a sensation that the world is about to end. So it's of no surprise to me, one way or the other.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, our time is up. But we have, I have the task, the honour, the pleasure of presenting this pile of book goodies to the person whose question I thought was the most pertinent and interesting. And I've decided, in my wisdom, that the lady in blue at the back who asked the first question, I thought that was a fascinating one. So fascinating, I've forgotten what it was. Here we are. And all all that remains is for me to thank our splendid panel, Charlie, Tom, Belinda, Adrian, and hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, Simon.